You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 117 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Boulevard Park, Washington, the home of the Peltoncast.
Oh, and it feels good to be back in Boulevard Park.
It sure does. We have a lot to get to today, so let's get right into it, starting with our beer, the Breakside Tall Guy IPA, which I picked up at Fred Meyer the other day. Was excited to see Ode to the Tropical Citra Hop, also whimsically refreshing, one size fits all.
Ah, well, I think a toast is in order before we get into it here.
A toast to the latest edition of Talkin' Taco Time, which hopefully you've already listened to, and if not, you should be listening to right now.
Episode 3 of Talkin' Taco Time, another classic.
Our first emergency podcast, which we had to record after visiting.
If there's another emergency Talkin' Taco Time, I'll be very shocked.
There could be. They could announce something. I don't know. But this was because of the we had to record because of the fact that we visited the other Taco Time in Yakima, Washington, on our way back from last weekend's hydroplane races in the Tri-Cities.
Stay tuned for more extensive hydroplane coverage on this podcast.
Several hours of Seafair preview coming. I guarantee you will not find a more comprehensive Seafair hydroplane preview than you find on the Fabulous Peltoncast, or your money back.
Wow. We should also toast to, by the way, this beer is pretty good.
It is.
We should also toast to the Fabulous Peltoncast live on August 29th at the Barboza as part of the Numos Complex. Get your tickets now.
Unless you listen to this Tuesday night immediately after it's released, you will be, by the time you listen to this, it will be no more than 4 weeks away from the live show. So definitely you're going to want to make sure you have your tickets.
Wow. The live show is going to have everything you could possibly want in the entire world. That means the inaugural edition of Trader Bros, the selection of Seattle's best taco / burrito, Talkin' Taco Time live, a Seahawks season preview with our friends at Tasteful Profanity, a Beast Pode production, plus special guests.
Oh.
Surprises.
Hey.
TBD.
I love TBD.
Things we haven't figured out yet.
We've only got 4 weeks to figure them out, so we need to get going on figuring them out, but you need to get going on getting those tickets. With that, should we turn our attention to a little bit different taco / burrito review this week? Because of the fact that we were so busy eating at various Taco Time locations, both Northwest and international.
I've eaten a lot of Taco Time lately.
We did not get to any of the places on our list in the past week. So instead, I've decided to review a couple of places that I went to a month ago and have been waiting for you to go to, and I've just given up on that hope entirely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not going to them.
All right, so first up,
I've been to each of those locations before, though.
Okay.
Multiple times to each.
First up is Fond de la Katrina in Georgetown, the second place we've evaluated in Georgetown. And it certainly is compared to the other location in Georgetown. It's more on the white cloth napkin, end of the taxonomy for tacos. But I would say that's in a very good way. So what I found out when I got there is they serve their tacos in, you have to get a group of three tacos, and you can't get different types of meat among the three tacos, but they told me that you could get multiple types of the meat on the tacos. So I got double meat, and I was thinking that's like going to be half of one, half of the other. And it turns out, no, they just threw both of them the regular amount on there. And it was an amazing amount of meat on these tacos. You can see in the photo that I'm going to post on Instagram.
It's basically like one giant taco.
It is. I mean, I had to eat the meat like loosely out of there with a fork before actually attempting to eat like a taco. But it was quite delicious.
So these tacos, you've got meat, you've got like a big slice of avocado on there, plus the pickled onion for like a refreshing fruity flavor.
I suppose. You can definitely have too much pickled onion in my opinion. God. I'm not going to eat all of that. I did mean, by the way, the quantity here, that it was a little tough to eat the three tacos plus the tamal that I ordered.
And so what did you think of it overall?
I thought it was really quite good. I mean, I don't know if it's quite a contender for Seattle's best taco, but it was up there. I would say like a solid 89, I think, for Fonda La Katrina.
Nice. And Fonda La Katrina was like, I would say, in the Halcyon pre-Tacos Chuki's days, it was one of the hottest taco restaurants in all of Seattle.
Ah, those pre-Tacos Chuki's days. Dark ages.
Back in the 2010 to 12.
I mean, still better than we learned. One of the things we discussed on this week's Talkin' Taco Time is apparently when Taco Time came to Seattle, people in Seattle did not yet know what a taco was.
Yes.
Just baffling to believe. I still refuse to accept it. We have not yet asked our mom about that.
About whether she's, there's no way she's going to remember.
I know. Okay, so the other place I went to,
we talk about how we're changing lives with the Peloton Cast, which we are, of course.
Taco Time changed lives?
Taco Time, I mean, almost everybody I know knows what a taco is.
That's true. Your children, your one-year-old child definitely knows what a taco is, has said it on this very podcast. So he's already ahead of people in 1962. Anyways, the second location I visited, I was doing these on the Saturday and Sunday before I went to Salt Lake City and then to Las Vegas for my summer league trip, trying to get some taco burrito locations ahead of time that we could discuss on the podcast, which we didn't until long after the fact. So this was after the Storm game on Sunday afternoon, and after LeBron James had just announced he was going to the Lakers, and I had written
spoiler alert.
Yeah. So I needed a place that was conveniently located to Key Arena and also not far out of the way on my drive back home, and found that in Cactus in South Lake Union, right near the Amazon complex, and stopped by there and got four different tacos. They were there. I was able to get tacos a la carte and try a bunch of different things. And I would say what stood out actually more even than the various meat tacos I had was they had a potato taco. And I think I'm very in on at this point on potato only tacos.
Yeah, man, on that.
So I was definitely, if we're talking about the taxonomy, Cactus falls way to the cloth napkin end of things. I mean, their tacos are ridiculously overpriced for street tacos. They were quite good, but I don't know if it's good enough to justify that kind of expense.
Yeah, Cactus to me is a place, it's not bad, right? I don't eat their food and say this is
absolutely
bad food to have.
No.
It reminds me of like a corporate worker gets off work and then goes to Cactus after.
Say an Amazon worker?
Could be. For that particular occasion, but there are other ones.
That's true.
That's who Cactus is catering to, though.
That's what their appeal is.
It's not a working class taco. This isn't the Loretta's of tacos.
It's decidedly not. No, it's more the 8 ounce burger bar of tacos, I would say, if we're making that.
I love how 8 ounce burger bar has become synonymous for us to have like cloth napkin.
Maybe just for me, but
I think there's one in the airport now, isn't there?
Wait, competing with the future Papa Woody's?
I saw an 8 ounce burger bar somewhere that I was surprised to see it.
I can't imagine it was the airport.
There's definitely another one. Maybe it's in Ballard. There appear to only be two locations.
All right, you've given up on this take entirely. That's fair. Okay, so we've got still a couple of key locations, I think, to hit before we get into the tournament portion of our search for Seattle's best taco/burrito, which will, of course, conclude at the live show on August 29th.
There are actually locations in Tunica, Mississippi, North Miami Beach, Bossier, Louisiana, and at the airport in L.A., which might have been what I was thinking of.
That, I guess, is more plausible. That is a plausible explanation.
Is this the same place? What in the world?
I think it is the same place. I think it is in the L.A. airport. I think that is correct.
I think that might have been where I saw it at LAX.
Okay.
Although, why am I not seeing burgers on their menu?
At 8 ounce burger bar?
I think this is I'm seeing sandwiches and salads and draft beers and small snacks, but no burgers. Come experience our all-natural char-grilled overwood flame. All-natural burgers over. Maybe they just list. I don't know. Maybe the burgers get their own page.
Yeah, I think you're
okay.
You're
yeah, just yeah, off yeah, on yeah. This. Okay, burgers are on page two.
That makes a lot more sense. 8 ounce burger bar could not have burgers. That would not make sense.
Oh, my God. Okay.
All right. Since a relatively brief segment on tacos and burritos this week, let's get into Seattle sports because there's a lot going on for a relatively quiet period, starting with an update on the new arena at Seattle Center. We mentioned on last week's podcast that there was going to be a meeting of the Seattle City Council Select Committee on Civic Arenas, a phrase that I've said entirely too often on this podcast. And the main thing we learned at that besides that things continue to be on track for a vote on the final term sheet and transaction documents with regard to the renovation rebuild in September, the main thing we learned is that the cost projection for the arena has increased to $700 million. And at a press conference Tuesday where the Oakview Group announced Scanza Hunt is the general contractor on the construction of the new arena, Tim Leiwicki was asked about this and explained that it was a combination of a couple of things. First, the Scanza Hunt group that is overseeing the construction has, quote, come up with a very unique way to excavate that will minimize the impact on the community. Leiwicki said, that's expensive, but it's worth it. And then the other aspect of it is that he said that they've added 50,000 square feet in capacity, which will allow them to both improve the locker room facilities, increase the size of those, and then also add premium space in the hopes that the new arena at Seattle Center will be within the top third of both the NBA and the NHL as far as its capacity to generate revenue. And that's an important factor because, so one thing that should be noted here is the cost of the additional cost of the arena won't affect Seattle taxpayers in any way. Oakview Group is covering all of that and, you know, has made it clear that they have the financing to cover the additional costs.
As we've discussed ongoing on this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, one thing we talked about last summer when the original memorandum of understanding was being negotiated was that it was important for the city of Seattle to protect itself by making sure that Oakview was responsible for all cost overruns, which the final MOU did declare. And these aren't necessarily overruns because it's still a projection, but, you know, a similar category. But what does happen is the more expensive the arena gets, the more revenue Oakview is going to have to be able to generate from it in order to justify that expense. And that's not necessarily an issue with the NHL because of the fact that that ownership group is integrated with Oakview, along with David Bonderman and Jerry Bruckheimer, who are specifically part of the NHL ownership group. But they'll be sharing in the benefits to Oakview, the proceeds that Oakview takes out, because they're going to be investors in the arena as well. If an NBA owner comes in and isn't an investor in the arena, then it might become more difficult for them to be profitable in the arena. And that's why it's important that they, you know, really believe that they would be able to maximize that premium space that Oakview has added to the plans.
Okay.
So,
I mean, when I see they've come up with a very unique way to excavate, what I see with that is cost overruns, missed deadlines, delays in production.
We'll see. I mean, they're very insistent about making this October 2020 deadline to start NHL play, then continue to use the expression NHL 2020. As we've discussed in the past on the podcast,
they're going to want to not put a date on that.
That's going to be contingent on their ability to construct outside the usual hours that are allowed for that. So we haven't really gotten an update on that or an updated version of the environmental impact statement, and that will be important to watch as this process continues over the next couple months here.
Where does the capacity put, especially for basketball, where does that put the arena with regards to the rest of the NBA?
Yeah, one of the other things we learned in today's press conference is, and is part of making this explanation of why the arena was going to cost more, Tim Leiwicki gave an update to the capacity of the arena, which will be 18,600 for basketball and 17,400 for hockey. That puts it, you know, a little bit below the median on the NBA, or right about, actually, I guess I would say the median on the NBA side. TD Garden would be the closest comp. Their capacity for 1,624. And, you know, as Leiwicki has said in the past, the trend lately has actually been more towards smaller arenas, although that may partially be a product of them going in smaller markets. The most recent arenas, the Milwaukee Arena, which will be opening up this year, and we just learned last week will be named Fiserv Forum, which really rolls off the tongue.
Oh, love it.
Capacity of 17,500. Golden One Center in Sacramento, 17,600. And then Barclays Center, 17,700.
Interesting. I didn't realize Barclays was so small.
So while we're on the topic of arenas and stadiums and funding for them, it's time for your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
So, last week, after we recorded the Pelton cast, I thought about recording an emergency Pelton cast just to complain about this. But
this wasn't as important as busy Taco Time International.
We have loose definitions about what an emergency is. At some point during Seahawks training camp, you know we're going to record an emergency pod. Something's going to happen. Earl Thomas is traded pod. We should start getting ready for it right now.
It's on the schedule.
we've already scheduled that emergency pod. But the Mariners last week showing their audacity after 17 years of missing the playoffs, what is now, I believe, the longest streak of playoff futility of any North American professional sports franchise.
That is correct in the Big Four sports.
Decided to request $180 million in public funding from the King County Council over to sign their 25-year lease extension at Safeco Field. At the Mariners, read the room. Given what has happened with the Sonics previously and with the negotiations for both of the options for this new arena, where did you think you would get away with getting $180 million in public funding? Was it the 17 years of playoff futility that maybe thought you would get that leverage? Was it wasting Felix Hernandez's entire career until the chance, the time that you're even sniffing the playoffs? He's a husk of what he used to be. Now is the time. They got over 50% playoff odds, and the Mariners were like, okay, now we need to request that money. They're like, we've got them right where we want them. Oh, given what happened in all of those other situations, it would be a travesty for the King County Council to approve this money going to renovations or upkeep at Safeco Field.
Yeah, and it's starting to look like that's not going to happen. So to unpack this and move backwards a little bit, what we learned last week from an excellent report by the Seattle Weekly is that the new 25-year lease that was announced in late May and approved by the Public Facilities District, which is the governmental independent group that oversees Safeco Field, was tied to the King County Council approving $180 million in public funding for the upkeep and capital improvement at Safeco Field. And now, after that kind of came to light, it is seeming increasingly unlikely that the Mariners are in fact going to be able to get this money. So where it's coming from.
Were they trying to sneak this one in, by the way?
I don't know that they necessarily were, but I don't know that they weren't either. Because,
God,
you know, I think the headline was Mariners, you know, sign, Mariners agree to new lease rather than, you know, about the funding. So basically what's happening here.
Mariners agree to new lease, hold city hostage.
County. Not city.
Sorry. Hold county hostage. I know this is a pet peeve of yours.
It is. It's the King County Council, not the Seattle City Council. It has nothing to do with the people who blocked the street vacation. It's an entirely different group of people altogether. Weirdly, those are different things, King County and the city of Seattle. They overlap. It's like a rectangle. It's like a rectangle and a square. All squares are rectangles, but not all rectangles are squares. Yeah.
You lost me there.
Okay. So there's a lodging tax fund, you know, people who come and stay in hotels in the city of Seattle. I don't know how this affects Airbnb. That's an interesting question. But they pay a tax, and the way that it works is by state law, 37.5% of that has to go to affordable housing, 37.5% of it goes to arts program, and the leftover goes to tourism promotion. And that tourism promotion has been used, broadly defined, to pay off the bonds that were used to construct both Safeco Field and CenturyLink Field. In 2020, those bonds will be completely paid off, and so that money will become available, and the Mariners are seeking to make sure that they continue to get that to Safeco Field to maintain it as it ages. And they would be funding some of the improvements themselves. The independent estimate cited by the Seattle Weekly, I believe, said $360 million in upkeep over this, you know, period. So the 180 million wouldn't cover all of it, but it would cover a substantial portion of it.
But just imagine that pitch when they're looking for the bonds initially, and then when the time period that they're actually paid off, they're like, yeah, but I mean, we still want that money, right?
Right. I mean, that's part of it is that, you know, there's a term called sunsetting, where basically this is kind of like a tax goes away. In this case, the tax doesn't go away, but the obligation to the stadiums was supposed to go away. And instead, the Mariners are looking to continue. But like I said, it's starting to look unlikely after the negative reaction to this piece by the Seattle Weekly.
Thank God. Thank God for the Seattle Weekly. I'm sure the Seattle Times reported nothing on this.
So, again, well, the Public Facilities District, they have reported on.
After the Seattle Weekly did.
Well, the Public Facilities District has approved tentatively this new lease contingent on the King County. It's contingent on the King County Council approving the funding. They held a meeting about this on Monday, and according to the Seattle Times account of it,
they managed to show up.
The testimony was mostly housing advocates and others opposing the stadium financing plan who had signs reading homes over home runs because of the idea that they could use more than 37.5% of this money from the lodging tax on affordable housing.
So what could the city of Seattle use more right now, and all of King County use more right now? Affordable homes or baseball?
So in response to this feedback, on Tuesday, Councilmember Jeannie Cole Wells, who had been the co-sponsor of the proposal, announced that she was withdrawing her sponsorship and instead plans to introduce an alternative amendment that will boost investment in affordable housing by $184 million and give just $25 million to the Safeco Field Capital Improvement and Upkeep Fund.
Still too much.
And, you know, if they've lost one of their biggest supporters, it seems very unlikely that the Mariners will get this full $180 million that they've requested.
When, who are the supporters of this who are out?
Like, outside of the council? I mean, look,
who are the people who are lobbying for this money to go to the Mariners?
No, the concern long-term, of course, is were the Mariners to move, then you've got Safeco Field sitting empty and of very limited value to the city of Seattle and the King County at that point.
But then we'd have a baseball team in Portland to go and visit.
You'd rather have the Mariners in Portland than Seattle? I mean, it really wouldn't change things for you that much. It's not like you attend games that often.
How much public money went to for the renovation of Key Arena to the Oakview Group?
Well, there's no money up front. Oakview Group, again, is covering all the initial costs. Now, what they are getting is it's the alternative cost of a lot of these revenue streams that the city of Seattle is currently getting out of Key Arena now will go to Oakview once they operate and manage the arena.
So, like, the city of – just understand that the city of Seattle is, like, running the vendors at Key Arena, and now Oakview will make money from those vendors?
And then there's a – you know, the ticket tax, they will no longer receive the ticket tax as part of an exemption.
But it's all stuff that's happening at the site.
Yes.
This is not money could be going to affordable housing or hockey and basketball.
Right. It's not as clear in that case.
And so in this situation, $25 million is still generous. Because to me, the precedent that has been set is such that the city should basically, and county, should basically be spending nothing on sports arenas.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously that deal, as far as the King Arena rebuild, was driven by the fact that there was the Chris Hansen proposal in Soto that would have involved no public financing whatsoever.
They had two options for it.
Yes.
So where do the Mariners think that they're getting this leverage from?
I mean, I think they're probably their past experience in terms of getting a public financing.
Times have changed.
Stadium.
This ain't 95. This ain't the house that Griffey built.
I mean,
King Griffey Jr. ain't walking through that door.
One thing that'll be interesting is, you know, we'll see how this kind of continues to evolve. Like I said, I'm very skeptical that they get the whole amount, but the final vote was originally scheduled to be held in September. And, you know, will the success or failure of the Mariners on the field affect this much as it did in 95, where the vote, you know, the public vote narrowly lost, but subsequently the state government, along with the county council, stepped in to build Safeco Field after the Mariners' miraculous playoff run in 95.
All right, that said, let's get Felix out there. I mean, he's paid his dues. Let's get him on the mound every three starts.
More, every five is enough. I mean, the other backdrop here, by the way, is the fact that the Seattle Times last Wednesday...
They should shut down James Paxton for the rest of the year and save him for next year.
The Seattle Times last Wednesday reporting that three women accused Mariners executives of inappropriate workplace behavior, including former President Chuck Armstrong and current President Kevin Mather. I would say that the Mariners' response to this has been generally positive, and it seems like the culture in the Mariners' front office is better now than it was previously. But nonetheless, certainly troubling allegations among people, among executives who do not seem to have suffered any consequences from it.
What do you mean the response has been generally positive?
That they've treated this as a serious matter and not dismissed it.
Okay. I'm just curious what the thing is that Chuck Armstrong is good at.
A lot of people went to Safeco Field.
Okay.
All right, so on the field with the Mariners, before Tuesday's non-waiver trade deadline, they acquired outfielder Cameron Maben from the Marlins for a prospect in international money. Maben currently on a one-year $3.25 million contract and hitting this season .251 with a .338 on-base percentage and .343 slugging, which sounded bad to me. But it turns out that maybe it's actually not that bad.
Really?
Because he surely will replace in the Mariners lineup center fielder Guillermo Heredia, whose current slash line is .229, .314 on base percentage, .335 slugging. So compared to him, Cameron Maben, a superstar offensively.
I mean, just looking at Cameron Maben's war over the last 10 years or so. I mean, all time, he's worth 13.5 wins. He's had some up-and-down seasons. He's played on a hell of a lot of teams lately.
That is accurate.
He has been around.
Won the World Series with the Astros last year.
Oh, well, good for him.
Yeah.
but
a crucial part of that victory.
The thing about Cameron Maben is he's usually not a negative.
Yeah, exactly. He's fine. That's how I would describe him. He's fine. This is not exactly the big swing at the trade deadline people might have been hoping for, but then given the state of the Mariners minor leagues, that was probably never realistic.
That they traded away their entire farm system last offseason, or last trade deadline. So far this year, Guillermo Heredia has been worth negative wins, so Cameron Maben being at exactly zero would be a positive.
Exactly. The Mariners have now moved two games up on the A's in the race for the second wild card and actually closed within three games of the Astros, currently visiting Safeco Field, pending the final two games of that series later on Tuesday night and then Wednesday. Still just a 4.4% chance of winning the AL West per FanGraphs simulation, but the overall Mariners playoff odds up to 64%. So speaking of teams whose playoff odds are increasing, a toast probably in order to the Seattle Sounders, who pulled off a 9-point week.
What
over an 8-day stretch, winning three matches. That's like a third of their total points for the season.
We have not been talking about them winning matches often.
They are not. They have actually scored more points in their last six matches, 14, than in their previous 15 matches when they had 12 points.
Wow.
So on they had previously already won on Sunday against the rival Vancouver Whitecaps. We discussed that on last week's pod. After that, they went down to San Jose on Wednesday night, and in a match that looked like it was destined for a 0-0 draw, instead pulled out the winner from Raul Ruy Diaz, making his first start as a Sounder.
There it is.
And netting his first goal as a Sounder and in the MLS on his birthday. A really impressive full debut from Ruy Diaz. And then on Sunday, the Sounders with a 3-1 win over NYCFC, which came in with a 434-minute scoreless streak and instead somehow became just the second team all season to concede three goals to the Sounders in MLS play. So
something is brewing here.
It does seem like it. We've talked a lot about the idea that they're a second-half team, and suddenly that's seeming more reality than it is like optimistic spin on things.
I mean, that win last week at San Jose is the exact type of game that they need to win. A game that they were destined to lose all along, or even draw. And somehow eking out 3 points from that one is unbelievable given the season so far.
Yeah, it was kind of weird. I mean, the San Jose has a really bad home record, and based on that, the Sounders broadcast team was kind of talking about how that was an easier game than at home versus NYCFC, which I think understates the value of home field advantage. Like, just because a team happens to be bad at home over 10 matches doesn't mean they're inherently bad at home.
Yeah.
Although it did work out that way for the Sounders.
I mean, they won 1-0, but they beat NYCFC 3-1.
This is true. In the context of their recent play, 1-0 actually not necessarily all that impressive. The Sounders now have moved within 5 points of Real Salt Lake for the last playoff spot in the Western Conference with a match in hand, and their playoff odds up to 41% per 538 Soccer Power Index, about three times where they sat 2 weeks ago.
They're playing in the cup final.
Oh, that confident now. So the Sounders continuing negotiations with Peruvian midfielder Paulo Hurtado.
No relation.
To John Kennedy?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. Who's not from Peru. He's from Colombia. I'm confident in saying they are not related to each other, that there's lots of Hurtados out there. Probably no relation to Edwin Hurtado, the favorite Mariners pitcher either. Apparently, they have set the transfer fee at $1.5 million with his club in Portugal, but the two sides continue to negotiate a contract for Hurtado ahead of the August 8th transfer deadline. Sounder at Heart reported on Tuesday that Hurtado is expected to be in Seattle this week. It seems very likely to happen, but there is still the possibility they hit a snag before the finish line.
He's in Seattle to sign the contract. Who are we kidding here?
It seems very likely.
You're not going to fly from Portugal to Seattle if it's not done.
I mean, I assume he's in Peru now, but that's actually a similarly long flight.
You're not going to fly from Peru to Seattle if it's not done.
Wednesday,
they can negotiate these things over the telephone or on the internet.
That is true.
So what does this Paulo Hurtado potential signing mean? He would be a designated player, right?
So he can't be a designated player right now because the Sounders are full up there, but he would probably become a designated player next season. Like, one of the theories that I've heard floated on Sounder at Heart and in other locations is that it would be basically a loan for the rest of this season with a future option to buy, and that would allow the Sounders to get away around the fact that they don't necessarily have enough in targeted allocation money to cover the full cost of the signing. Increasingly unlikely that Clint Dempsey will be part of the Sounders beyond the 2018 season.
Interesting, though. I mean, why is every team not doing this?
I mean, you know, you want to usually maintain those DP spots long term. So, you know, it's not like you could continually be doing this every year. It's just a unique situation where the Sounders have Dempsey under contract for this year, but probably are ready to move on from him with the addition of Rui Diaz and the return of Jordan Morris, presumably, in 2018.
Okay.
So Wednesday is the MLS All-Star Game, where the MLS All-Stars will be taking on Juventus.
Go Juventus. Go Juve.
In the classic format that the MLS has used. There are no Sounders on the roster. I don't think we've
is that the classic format that the MLS uses?
I don't think we've ever discussed the Sounders in the MLS All-Star Game. It just never even seemed like a consideration. On Saturday, though,
Is Cristiano Ronaldo expected to play in that match?
I am not clear on that. On Saturday, though, the Sounders will be back in action at Minnesota United in an important match as part of their playoff push. Minnesota comes in 2 points ahead of Sounders in the Western Conference standings, despite having the league's second worst rating by Soccer Power Index. The Loons have a -9 goal differential as compared to a -2 goal differential for the Sounders, who are in sixth place, seventh place rather, in the Western Conference. Real Salt Lake is mentioned in the sixth playoff spot right now, has a -8 goal differential, a sign that they will likely decline. But the Houston Dynamo, who are only 1 point ahead of the Sounders in the standings, have a +7 goal differential.
You've said a lot of words here.
basically, goal differential says Real Salt Lake is in Minnesota have both been very fluky in their success. The Sounders have probably been a little unlucky, and Houston has been massively unlucky, but may not be as capable of taking advantage of that luck as the Sounders are.
And this match is huge this weekend.
Yeah, there's a chance to move ahead of Minnesota in the standings if the Sounders could get a full 3 points.
I mean, they would be in a position to strike for the playoffs if they could pick up a W here.
I mean, they're in a position to strike for the playoffs either way, but it would, again, further improve that position if you could somehow get 3 points on the road.
Man.
Even solid if they can get a draw.
I love these times when we talk about things really, like, direly for a long time, and then it turns around.
So you're saying every Sounders season?
Yes. I think there were some Seahawks seasons thrown in there also. There,
yeah, the 2014 season was very Seahawks season was very much like that. And I kept being like, ah, you know, you can't guarantee they're going to turn it around. And then they turned it around.
Yeah.
But then last year they didn't.
Yeah, no, they didn't. I remember that.
Actually, that was the 2015 season I'm thinking of here, not 2014, which was the second Super Bowl run. The Seattle Reign will be back in action this Sunday, hosting 8th place Washington at home in a game that they should probably get full 3 points from. They were off last week, of course, for the U.S.
What is Washington's nickname?
No, I was going to say the Pride Spirit, maybe?
The Generals.
Oh, okay. The U.S. Women's National Team in action in the Tournament of Champions beat Japan 4-2 with a Megan Rapinoe goal and assist, and then drew 1-1 versus Australia on Sunday, the equalizing goal coming in the 90th minute off a Rapinoe corner for her second assist of the Tournament of Champions. USWNT must beat Brazil on Thursday's finale to have a chance to win the tournament that they are hosting. So it'd be a little disappointing if not, but Australia right now probably the favorite in that. Speaking of All-Star games, the Seattle Storm playing in the WNBA All-Star game last Saturday, and Jewel Lloyd won bragging rights after her team Parker beat Team Deladon in the All-Star game with rosters chosen by draft rather than by conference. Team Deladon had the greater Storm contingent with Sue Bird and Brianna Stewart in the starting lineup and the Storm coaching staff coaching that team. Jewel Lloyd had 12 points in 17 minutes off the bench. On as far as the losing team, Brianna Stewart had 10 points and 5 rebounds, and Sue Bird 5 points and 8 assists in the game, where Maya Moore was named MVP as Minnesota hosted. The Storm will be playing Minnesota at home at Key Arena on Friday, their first home game since July 14th. But first, before that, later Tuesday night, they will be visiting Phoenix in another important game. They then head out on another 4-game road trip, having just come off what will be a 5-game road trip, including this Phoenix game after the break. That starts with a back-to-back at New York and Indiana to lottery teams next Monday, Tuesday, that you'd hope the Storm sweep those games to solidify their spot atop the WNBA, which they currently lead by 2.5 games.
And do they right now have the number one championship odds in the entire WNBA?
They do.
Wow.
I mean, they've got the best record. They've got the best point differential. They look like the best team right now. I mean, you're certainly wary of Minnesota and LA, two experienced championship teams, both of whom, you know, have kind of underperformed a little bit during the regular season, more or less due to injuries, probably more in the Sparks case and a little bit less in the Lynx's case. But, you know, going off this year's performance, the Storm have been the best team in the WNBA.
All right.
So, like I said, time to get excited about the Storm as they kick off the second half of the season. The sprint to the finish line here, because the first half of the season was actually like 26 games.
I have some urgent and breaking food news.
Is it horrifying?
No, the exact opposite.
Okay.
From the headline, cult favorite bakery, Milk Bars, coming to Seattle.
What?
For a day.
Oh, wow. It was like, you got my hopes way too far up. Tell me more. Tell me more about this breaking, developing story.
From the good folks at Seattle Times, who I would never say anything bad about. There's going to be a Milk Bar pop-up in the Canlis parking lot on August 12th, coming up very soon.
Huh. So very similar to the Shake Shack pop-up that we saw in the Canlis parking lot last month.
There they'll have all the Milk Bar favorites, the birthday cake truffles, which I think we've raved about extensively.
We have.
The cereal milk soft serve, crack pie, of course. And they're going to do it as part of like a county fair concept. And they're going to have, from the Canlis chef Brady Williams, corn dogs, turkey legs, and a popcorn stand as run by the chef of Milk Bar's husband.
Interesting. So you're also going to have a VIP hour from 11 a.m. to noon before it opens to the public, general public. So that's going to be interesting if you want to assure that you're going to get it without having to stand in line for hours and hours. More details on this as they become available. Wait, what was the date on this?
August 12th. It's a Sunday.
So I will not be here.
This is another situation where I'm just going to put this out there. The Canlis parking lot is not a good place to hold these events. I understand you want exclusivity, but you got to open it up a little bit.
I know. I mean, the Canlis parking lot is just like for valeting, basically. It's not like the you're going to the CenturyLink Field parking lot here.
I mean, these events should be at Seattle Center at the Mural Amphitheater. I'm putting it out there right now.
Okay.
If you're listening, what is the chef of Milk Bar's name?
Christina Tosi.
If you're listening to this, move it to Seattle Center, just like I told Shake Shack.
Okay. They will continue to be extremely successful, profitable businesses without your advice. Well, that was an important update. I'm glad you broke in for that. Next on our sports roundup, UW football, where, as we mentioned last week, Wednesday was Pac-12 Media Day. The Huskies were, of course, selected atop the Pac-12 media poll,
man,
earning 37 of 42.
Of course selected makes me a little bit scared.
It is.
I don't like hearing those words.
It is a weird place to be. Earning 37 of 42 first place votes to win the Pac-12 overall and 40 of 42 in the Pac-12 North. Probably the biggest news to come out of Chris Peterson's media availability, in which he tried as hard as possible to say as little interesting as he possibly could, was an update on the status of tight end Hunter Bryant. Peterson said that Bryant did in fact have surgery and will not be ready at the start of the season. He may end up redshirting. Now the NCAA is allowing players to play up to 4 games in a season and still redshirt for that season. So it's possible that Bryant, if he were able to return at the end of the year, could play in up to the last 4 games and still retain an extra year of eligibility.
This is an awesome rule change.
It is a good rule change. And Chris Peterson seemed very favorable about it. He actually would like players to just have 5 years of eligibility, period, and not have a red shirt whatsoever.
He wants players to be able to play forever and never get paid.
What a bold
stance by Chris Peterson.
I mean, nobody's forcing you to play. Like, you could still go to the NFL at the same timetable. It actually would be, I guess it wouldn't change anything, but you wouldn't have to make that decision about will a player play, and it's like the all or nothing decision. I think that's what's nice about this.
Yes. Or if you put somebody in for, if you just need some depth for a couple games.
Well, like the thing that was brought up to him in the media availability, and presumably to other coaches as well, is that it's really important for quarterbacks, where usually you would be very reticent to play a true freshman quarterback because you wouldn't want to burn that year of eligibility. Now, if you want to give them a series at the end of an early season game, that will not affect their eligibility.
It doesn't mean anything for transfer redshirts, though.
No, they have not changed the transfer.
Jacob Eason will still have to sit out for a full year. But it does mean, so you have these, I don't know what the Husky schedule is, but I think some relatively easy games after they play on the neutral site in Atlanta, Georgia against Auburn.
My favorite neutral site, Atlanta, Georgia.
They have some relatively easy games after that. They're playing like, what, Montana or something?
North Dakota will be the second game of the season on September 8th. That's really the only game that you'd look at. The other non-conference game, September 29th, BYU.
Okay. So you have at least this one game where presumably the Huskies will be winning by quite a bit, and you can play players in that game. You can give them actual game experience rather than having to wait another season. Yeah, or, I mean, there could be blowouts during the Pac-12 season. It's a bit of strategy when you use players.
Right, yeah.
I like it. But then also for people like Hunter Bryant, who are coming back from this injury, instead of having to sit out a full year, if he should be able to come back, it means that he could potentially play in a bowl game, in a conference championship game, at the end of the season in the Apple Cup. Should any of these things matter?
And Peterson says it'll still be a month or two before they even, quote, kind of really see where he's at. So there's still a ways out from having an idea whether he'll be able to potentially come back at all. But nice to have that option.
So the thing that's crazy to me, seeing all this love for the Huskies, is are we going into this year, the initial polls I don't think have been released yet, but they should be coming relatively soon.
I believe the expectation is the Huskies will be about number 5.
Are we looking at a preseason number 5 team?
I think that's the expectation.
Oh my God. It's too much to handle.
Is it?
It's too scary being good.
Well, would you like to know who does not have high expectations going into this?
Who's that?
That's the Seattle
there
Seahawks.
There we go.
Observers are down on the Seahawks.
This we're used to.
And players are loving it.
Who was it predicted that they would be 4-12?
I don't know who did that. That was not a strong prediction. I feel like I'm pretty pessimistic
against
the Seahawks. I'm like 7-9. 8-8, maybe 7-9. So a couple of injury updates from the first couple of weeks of training camp. Deion Jordan has yet to practice because he's dealing with a stress reaction in his shin, according to Tom Pelissero of the NFL Network. He's expected out a week or two. And then Doug Baldwin missing, quote, a few weeks, according to Pete Carroll, with a knee injury. These are, now, this early in training camp, this is not a big deal. But if there were two positions where the Seahawks cannot afford any injuries. I thought
there was also a Frank Clark was injured also. Still recovering from surgery.
I don't think that that's any sort of long-term concern. But if there were any two positions where the Seahawks could not afford injuries, it would be number one wide receiver and number two defensive end, because those are the places where they have the least depth. So
it's rough. I mean, the thing is about the pass rush, they're relying heavily on Deion Jordan.
Yep.
And also Frank Clark being healthy. I mean, you could be
looking... Michael Bennett is not walking through that door.
You could be looking at a pass rush that was not that great last year, and they've lost Sheldon Richardson and Michael Bennett and have an injured Deion Jordan, who knows how long this injury will extend for, plus Frank Clark recovering from surgery.
Tristan Sigh. In happier news, an extension for Dwayne Brown that will pay him 3 years and a max of $36.5 million. Adds $4.5 million in new money to his what was previously $10 million guaranteed this year, plus $1.75 million of his 2019 salary will be guaranteed for injury. So, you know, even though this is a big number in terms of the total money, in terms of what the Seahawks are actually guaranteeing Brown above what he was already guaranteed this year in the final year of his contract, doesn't seem that substantial.
I mean, he's an older left tackle.
He is, yeah.
If
he plays well, he'll make a good amount of money.
Sure.
But the Seahawks are protected in case he ages quickly or suffers injury.
Yes, the longevity for left tackles. It seems like it's not like a running back where they just fall off a cliff productivity-wise, especially at a younger age. But there's not a long history of really good left tackles well into their 30s.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, basically probably Dwayne Brown will be close to year-to-year, I think, beyond this season. But, again, it gives the Seahawks some, you know, level of security with his potential future, not having him be a free agent after this year.
Yes.
They'll have control over his future. Another interesting report, Ian Rappaport of the NFL Network reported that Seahawks are, quote, showing the most interest in cornerback Dominic Rogers-Cromartie, who is a free agent after being waived by the Giants in March. He had played primarily in the slot the last couple of seasons, where the Seahawks lost some depth when, on the eve of training camp, DeAndre Elliott was waived with a failed physical designation. So they still have Justin Coleman in that position, but Nico Thorpe has been working as the backup nickel corner in practice so far.
Who are the starting corners right now?
Well, Byron Maxwell and Shaquille Griffin. Cool. Richard Sherman also not walking through that door.
And you know who also is not walking through that door?
Well, sadly, Malik McDowell.
I was going to say Earl Thomas, but you went to the
I mean, Earl Thomas, not really any update on his holdout. Malik McDowell, whose Seahawks career has come to an end less than a year after he was unable to report for the starting training camp after what was reported to be an ATV accident and a very serious concussion. And, no surprise to anyone, the Seahawks waiving him on the eve of training camp. Disappointing, particularly in the context of glowing reports from Green Bay training camp Kevin King.
Oh, I mean, first off, Malik McDowell, what a strange and tragic situation.
That's very sad. I mean, look, you know, the Seahawks, to not get anything out of a high second-round draft pick, yeah, that's a disappointment. But they'll have more second-round draft picks. Malik McDowell only has one career and one life, and sadly it seems like, well, his life will continue. His career may already be over.
And the Seahawks only had one chance to draft Kevin King. And why didn't they do it?
Oh, well, we've reached the area of grievances portion of the program.
Outstanding. I mean, there's also Buda Baker. He was a Pro Bowler last year. They could have drafted either of these players, and they chose not to.
Also, some strong reports about Sidney Jones from Eagles training.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, let's not go too far with this. There are glowing reports about everyone. Oh, if they're not glowing
reports about
you.
Kevin King's going to be a star. Come on.
It seems likely.
Buda Baker was already a Pro Bowler in year one. What are we doing? It's a good thing that the Legion of Boom is set for the next 10 years, though. God. No way we could draft a cornerback. We're already set at corner.
You have any other thoughts on Seahawks training camp?
They drafted Shaq Griffin last year also. Man, What if the corners were Shaq Griffin and Kevin King going
into
this year?
I mean, realistically, if they drafted Kevin King, they wouldn't have drafted.
I know.
Shaquille Griffin, which, whom, by the way, again, you can't call Shaq anymore. Shaquem's out there. He's intercepting passes.
Glowing reports about Shaquem Griffin. Oh, right? Yeah. Ah, Tedrick Thompson's going to be a star this year. He's the new Earl Thomas. Oh, my God. I know. We probably... Shaquille Griffin, there's probably a better chance of him right now being a better player than Kevin King.
That's an interesting question. I mean, it's tough to say.
I mean, he already has a successful year under his belt. He as does. A starter, which Kevin King doesn't really have.
He was also probably put in a more favorable position, I would say, than Kevin King was as a rookie. Like, you know, playing opposite Sherman is a relative, which he wasn't at the end of the season, in fairness. But that's like a relative, with Earl Thomas behind you, that's a relatively soft landing compared to what Kevin King got in Green Bay.
Are you sure about that? Oh, I guess Earl Thomas besides you. Not, you're still on the side of the field opposite Richard Sherman, though, who doesn't really follow star receivers.
That is true. But nonetheless, you know, having being effectively the number two receiver is useful from that standpoint. In terms of the safeties, it seems like a fair amount of Maurice Alexander running alongside Bradley McDougald. I don't know about this whole Delano Hill, Tedrick Thompson thing.
One is going to be released.
No, I don't believe that.
You think both make the team?
I mean, that would be four safeties right there. Because Mike Tyson has been playing at safety some too. So
also, Dominique Rogers-Cromartie will be... Did you already talk about this?
Yeah.
He'll be signed and released also.
Okay. I mean, we didn't really get into Dominique Rogers-Cromartie because we spun to the Kevin King discussion. But yeah, I mean, it feels like the classic, like, Seahawks pick someone up for like 3 weeks of training camp. Sometimes they guarantee them a lot of money and he plays for like 10 weeks. But yeah, the classic Seahawks.
I mean, there's no way that Dominique Rogers-Cromartie is on the team at the end of the season.
I mean, the fact is, I can't even remember who was the veteran quarterback they brought in for 10 weeks for the Eagles anymore.
That's the Eagles.
Yeah, when they lost Byron Maxwell there.
Oh man.
See,
there's Antoine Winfield, right?
Winfield is another. He's maybe a more comparable Dominique Rogers-Cromartie comparison.
How are you feeling about football in general? You seem to have come around a little bit on football.
I'm not as negative about it.
This is the cycle of paying attention to football. You think you're treating you being down on football in like May and June as football's fault, or you've changed about football. It's just how you always feel, and then football comes back, and you're watching Hard Knocks, and you're listening to Liev Schreiber. Yep. You're listening to Liev Schreiber talk about football and close-ups on blades of glass and pylons, and you're like, all right, I'm in.
Blades of glass?
Blades of grass.
That's a strange choice. This is all true. I would say I was more down on football than normal.
The Liev Schreiber stuff was all true. You're like, yep,
checks out. You know what really got me is the video of Michael Robinson at Seahawks training camp where he's playing one-on-one against Pete Carroll, and Pete Carroll gave him the drop step spin move. Like, you know, look. I mean, I can forgive a lot when I see that.
Yeah, yeah, you're like lobsters are fine, whatever. You gave Mike Rob the drop step spin move.
I didn't
We've
say
moved
that.
On. When there have been so many negative baseball stories, it feels a little bit better about
football.
That's
true. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Look, the Seahawks didn't just demand $180 million in public money.
That's true. It's only a matter of time, probably. But
they're actually a team that people enjoy watching. I think the Seahawks actually are in a very unique, lucky position because they're going to see the Mariners fail at this and then not attempt it.
Yes, I think that's probably true. I mean, or at least if they do it, go about it a better way. But it's a really tough time to be asking for public money in the city of Seattle.
Anyway, reports out of Packers camp are that Jimmy Graham has really gelled with Aaron Rodgers quickly.
Is it true?
Yeah. Oh, my God. But it's okay. We've got... Ed Dixon?
No, not Ed Dixon, who has also been injured, which is why the Seahawks signed like three tight ends at the start of training camp, which is really baffling.
Oh my God.
Whew. I've been spending all this time trying to figure out who the cornerback was the Seahawks released early in the 2015 season. Kerry Williams.
Oh, there it is. So in the long lineage of Kerry Williams, Antoine Winfield, and soon-to-be Dominique Rogers-Cromartie, so we can all react to the signing, and then he'll be released.
Much like the wide receivers with Brandon Marshall, and then what, T.O.?
Terrell Owens and Braylon Edwards.
And then do we go far enough back to Jerry Rice? Or we not
that was them? A different situation.
It was a different time. Anything else on the Seahawks?
Can't wait for the is tonight the premiere of Hard Knocks on HBO.
That seems logical, but I do not know for sure that
I'm so ready to hear that Leif Schreiber and see those close-ups of pylons.
Oh, it's going to be such a well framed pylon. It's really going to be gorgeous. They do great work with that. That's like the NFL's best marketing. Their worst marketing is everything else.
Browns Mayfield not letting Hard Knocks cameras in RV.
That is a story.
Wait, have you seen the story?
About the RV?
Yeah.
The quarterback only RV? Yeah, that's a big thing.
Oh, we know about this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Hard Knocks camera part of it, I didn't specifically know.
Oh, it'll premiere next week.
Okay. Okay.
Quarterbacks only RV? Well, we're going to have to wait another week. You're going to have to imagine pylons in your head. Maybe go back and watch previous seasons. Also, groundskeepers drawing the lines of chalk on the field.
It's a little disappointing. No Hard Knocks episode made the Ringer's top 100 episodes.
Wait, that's kind of crazy that it didn't.
I mean, it'd be, what would you pick out? I don't know.
They managed to pick out like an episode of Oprah.
Like maybe one of the episodes with Brian Cox. I feel like that was a strong season, that Falcons season. Anyways, we wanted to quickly, before we get to our extensive Seafair preview, wanted to quickly discuss a movie that I saw last week, which was Sorry to Bother You. Building buzz, I would say, is an offbeat, intriguing movie of the summer with Lakeith Stanfield as its star.
And first previewed during the, oh my God, why can't I remember the name of this episode? It was the episode with the guy.
I can do a little bit of the voice, but I can't remember the name of the episode.
Yeah, do that voice while I look it up.
Well, Tristan, you'll remember the name of the episode shortly.
In the Teddy Perkins episode.
Yes.
The Teddy Perkins episode of Atlanta started with Lakeith Stanfield talking to us.
It really set the tone for the whole thing. I'm sorry. It really set the tone for the whole thing.
And then goes into a preview of Sorry to Bother You, plus this disorienting episode of Atlanta, which is the Lakeith Stanfield episode, basically.
Yes. I mean, I've never been high in my life, but I assume that's what it's like all the time.
Okay.
Anyway, so I watched this movie in the theaters last week.
Wow!
Yeah.
You went to a movie theater. What's the situation here? Set the picture.
So I went to the 11:15 a.m. showing of this at South Center. There were four people in the theater.
I was going to say, I'm shocked that there was another soul in that theater.
All of us were there individually. It was a great time.
Oh, my God. There were four lonely souls at the theater. So pick up rainbow-colored pianos.
Very, yeah, it was very fun to watch and thought-provoking. But I learned afterwards in discussing that you have a history with the director of this movie, Boots Riley.
You want to get it? I want to hear about the movie first.
I mean, I don't know how much to say about the movie itself. I mean, you know, it's inevitably has been compared to Get Out, and there are elements, I think, thematic elements that are similar, but it's a wholly different story, I would say, than Get Out.
Is there a plot, like a theme that goes all the way across?
Yeah.
Okay.
But there's...
Is it whimsical?
There are also twists and turns along that particular path. It is definitely very whimsical and yeah, surreal, I think would probably be a good way to put it. It's set in, like, basically, it's an alternate version of reality, but a reality that's, like, close enough that, therefore, it's like looking in a funhouse mirror of present-day society, and, therefore, you reflect on the satire that provides.
I'm so excited to watch this movie in, like, however many months once it's on streaming services or whatever.
Yes.
Because I have 10 to 15 children, and I'm not going to see Sorry to Bother You at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday. You wanted me to talk about my relationship with Boots Riley?
Yes.
It was brief.
Yes.
So Boots Riley is the rapper from the group The Coup. Legendary rap group. Steal This Album is their most notable album, right?
This is his directorial debut, and a major shift in career, perhaps driven by you.
I wish this was a better story. I wish I had the email. But I had booked them one time at the Vera Project to play there, and ticket sales weren't great. Boots Riley stepped into the conversation at some point and had all these random people picking up flyers for the show. It was a strange situation for the show in general. So then the show happens. It was fine. But it was, let's say that there were like, there should have been maybe 400 people there. And there were actually like 200 people there. It's like a Sunday night in February, right? Promoting this coup show is not the easiest thing in the world. Also, the coup had played in Seattle quite a few times. So then a couple weeks later, and I've been a big coup fan since like, I don't know, the year 2001 or something.
And that led you to book them?
Well, I mean, I would have booked almost anything. That the agent routing the tour and hitting me up for holds is what led me to book them.
Okay.
If I, without getting too far into the booking process, choosing artists that you really like out of the air is not really how it goes. Okay. Despite what most people may think. Maybe we offered them more money. Vera Project definitely lost like at least $1,000 on the show. A couple weeks go by and I'm at, oh God, the... What is that? Fat Belly Sandwiches. What is that place called? No, that's not right.
Potbelly.
Potbelly Sandwiches on like a Sunday 2 weeks later. And I get an email from Boots Riley and I'm like, this can't be good. And it's like six long paragraphs long just about how we fucked up the marketing for the show, about how nobody was there, how the group was ruined in the city of Seattle and that they would never be able to play in Seattle again.
Wow.
And so.
And because of the fact that they couldn't play in Seattle again, he had to turn toward movie making. And the result was Sorry to Bother You.
Full page ad in the newspaper. You're welcome, Boots Riley. I said you needed a pivot to video and you've done it very successfully.
Anyways, definitely worth watching in the likely case that you haven't done so yet. And
I'm sorry that I ruined your career.
And if you're not going to wait
rap career
several months until it's on streaming services like Tristan is. All right, it is time. We got to talk about Seafair.
Do we?
We do, of course. It's a staple of the summer. And the highlight of it, despite what the schedule might tell you, despite what the interest in the Blue Angels might tell you, is, of course, the unlimited hydroplane race on Lake Washington.
There it is. So last weekend, we were in the Tri-Cities for Tri-City Water Follies on the Pasco side. What was the result of that race?
All right. So basically, the situation right now in unlimited hydroplane racing is that there are two top competitors. One of those is the U1 Miss Home Street Bank, the defending national high points champion for the last several seasons here, driven by Jimmy Shane, a Maryland native who now works at Jeff Bezos' rocket company. I think it's Blue Horizon.
Really?
And lives in the South King County area.
There we go.
I think in Kent. So he, in this context, and Home Street is based in Seattle, the local team, even though it's actually the boat is the Miss Madison, owned by the citizens of Madison, Indiana.
My stomach is like churning over here. I've got a lot of strong feelings in different directions.
Yeah, which also hosts one of the five races on the, or the six races, I guess, on the current unlimited hydroplane schedule.
So what are the six locations?
There's Madison, Guntersville, Alabama, which joined the circuit this year. The Tri-Cities, and then Seattle, Detroit, and San Diego are the major cities that remain on the circuit. Okay, so the rival now is Andrew Tate, son of Mark Tate, one of the top drivers in the early 90s when hydroplane racing was at its modern peak in terms of competitiveness and interest. And it started where, you know, Shane, despite not being much older than Andrew Tate, was the much more experienced driver. This is his 10th year on the unlimited circuit. And he had kind of established himself as the dominant figure. Tate came up as a rookie last year and quickly established himself as a challenger, winning two of the last three races. And he's now won two of the first three races this week, including last weekend in the Tri-Cities. Yeah, and perhaps as notable as him winning the race was it was a horrible weekend for Jimmy Shane in the Home Street Bank team, which was disqualified from two of the four heat races because of technical violations relating to their engine and something that was going wrong there.
It was a horrible, horrible weekend for us also because we had to eat the other taco time.
No. So shortly before the final, they make the decision that because of these continued technical violations, they have to change engines to avoid this potentially happening to them again in the winner-take-all final heat. And they swap it out like basically right before the boat goes on the water, but their preparation is kind of thrown off. And so the key to unlimited hydroplane racing is the jockeying for lanes that occurs between the – there's a five-minute gun 5 minutes before the race, and then the start of the race, you know, is when zero is on the clock, when you can hit the start-finish line. And as part of this kind of milling period, Brian Perkins, in kind of a non-competitive boat, the Albert Lee Appliance, had taken lane one. And then lane two was Andrew Tate. And Jimmy Shane was coming up behind a group of boats, and he kind of forced his way into lane three, and in the process washed down the J&D Plumbing, the U-11 driven by Tom Thompson, which had went dead in the water, had to stop and then try to restart and catch up with everyone from behind. And as a result of this maneuver, originally he was penalized a lap, and then after they reviewed the tape later, they determined that he was disqualified from the final heat altogether.
Wow!
So instead of finishing second behind Andrew Tate, who pulled away like about halfway through the first lap.
Were they competing, though? Was did Jimmy Shane know that he was being penalized?
It's unclear whether he had any idea that he was going to be penalized. I mean, he had to know that he had washed down the other boat. Like, it's very clear that, you know, like, you they have the on-camera video, on-board videos, and, like, it's, there's no debate about whether this should have been a penalty. It was obviously a penalty. And the fact that he was so non-competitive, it, either the engine that they swapped in was just not nearly as ready to go, or that he didn't know because of the fact that Tate was so dominant in pulling away for this victory. And generally, they're pretty evenly matched. It's mostly, you know, whoever's going to get the inside lane or have the better start, like if the inside the boat that's inside gets a weaker start.
So what you're saying is that there's an old wily vet. There are only two teams in hydroplane racing that really matter. Nobody else is an actual contender, and they meet each other in the finals, final race, every single race. And there is an old wily vet who at the last deadline had to change out everything about his team to try to remain competitive, but still was destroyed by the young upstart.
Something like that, yes. I don't know if I would quite say that Jimmy Shane is LeBron. He's not the probably the GOAT of hydroplane racing. If Chip Hanauer is the Michael Jordan of this conversation, Chip Hanauer remains untouched. And I don't know where Dave Vilwalk falls into the whole thing, or Steve David. But
yeah, we're gonna do our top 100 hydroplane drivers on the podcast blog.
That's a great idea
with additional video linked in there. What happens in hydroplane racing for every single person who could possibly be listening who has no idea about it is that the race is decided during this jockeying period.
Yes.
If there are two boats that are competitive with each other and they're basically the same quality and one gets the inside lane, they're going to win 100% of the time.
Although Shane did in the second set of heats on Saturday beat Tate from the outside because of the fact that he got a better start and was able to kind of get the jump on him.
Or at the very least, if it's not done in this jockeying period, hydroplane races are over basically before the first turn.
These two boats have had pretty competitive races in the past where they've kind of gone back and forth. So it's certainly plausible that that could happen. It is not like if anyone else is going to beat them, and the only real other contender I would say is the U12 Graham Trucking driven by J. Michael Kelly, who won last year's Tri-Cities race. They missed the first two races of this season due to mechanical issues, and then were still limited by that on the first day of the Tri-Cities races, did not finish the first heat. The second heat got disqualified for another one of these technical violations, and that forced them to be the trailer behind the rest of the boats at the start of the final, so they had no chance of competing in the final at that point. But, you know, if he got inside both of those boats, it was like another non-competitive boat in between them and the Graham Trucking, it's possible that they could win. So that's like the third maybe challenger.
So what should we expect from Seafair this weekend?
So I think it's going to be a weekend where Jimmy Shane is really motivated to have a much more successful weekend coming off the disappointment of the Tri-Cities. And in the hometown race for now him and his sponsor, you know, I think this will be an important weekend. And one thing I didn't mention, so is we talk about this rivalry between the two of them. Last year's Seafair was an interesting turning point because the Andrew Tate won on the water in the Les Schwab, but was later penalized for hitting a buoy, and that's what allowed Jimmy Shane to win last year's Seafair. but that was the first time they had kind of gone head-to-head in that important of a situation, and Andrew Tate had come out on top, even though he didn't in the actual final results.
Another fun thing about hydroplane racing is sometimes you don't know who wins until well after the race is over.
Very often. Very often. It's like if they couldn't call a foul until after the game ended.
But the other thing about hydroplane racing is a lot of the people involved are from the greater Seattle area.
Oh, the majority of them, yes.
So it would be like this LeBron, Steph Curry analogy, LeBron Warriors analogy. If Jamal Crawford was like basically the greatest player of all time or one of the best players of all time, and like Isaiah Thomas was like the fifth best player of all time.
I mean, there's about as many hydroplane drivers from Seattle as there are NBA players from Seattle. It's just that there's like 400 other NBA players.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, the long storied history of Seafair, this is the hub, the central hub of hydroplane racing, and that's what makes Seafair such an exciting race. So the other thing that's kind of going on here is the season high points race. There, because of Jimmy Shane's poor weekend last week in Tri-Cities, Andrew Tate has opened up a huge lead. He now is first with 5,280 points, and Shane has actually dropped to third with 3,360 points behind the aforementioned Tom Thompson in the U11 J&D Plumbing.
He sounds like a baseball relief pitcher.
Yes. So this would be a huge disappointment because that U1 Home Street Bank team has really prioritized the season high points championship historically, and they've won it several years in a row.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So...
What about kind of the future of the sport of hydroplane racing?
I think it's looking great.
On this very podcast last year, you may have boldly predicted, or on one of the podcasts, that was going to be the last year of hydroplanes being at Seafair.
Was that an official bold prediction? I don't know. We'll see. But they're down to, in the past, usually you'd have probably about 12 boats would enter the races, and sometimes up to, 14 or 15. This year, we've got 9 for the Tri-Cities and Seattle races, which is on the lower side. And for the previous races, there were 5 and 6.
Oh, my God.
Respectively.
5 and 6?
Yeah, I mean, you see more boats compete on the Seattle Tri-City swing because, again, it's closer. It's easier to get sponsors in these locations, all that sort of thing.
What would it cost for the Pelton Cast to sponsor a boat?
Still too much for the Pelton Cast.
Talking taco time?
Maybe taco time. I would wholly endorse a Taco Time Northwest Hydroplane.
I don't know if that's really a good use of their money.
It would be a problem because on the east side of the mountains, people would just go to the other Taco
Time. They
would
be so confused. They could sponsor it just for Seattle.
They could potentially do that, yes.
I'm not. I was going to demand that Taco Time sponsor a hydroplane, but I don't think that's a good
decision. But at the same time, people are still continuing to invest in hydroplanes. The Home Street Bank team... constructed a new hydroplane that they debuted in the Tri-Cities. So they've now got their kind of older boat and the newer one. The older one was the one they actually raced. But it's possible this weekend, given the struggles that one had, that we could see the newer boat make its full competitive debut.
Wow.
At Seafair.
What drama.
Yeah. So I think that mostly covers what you need to know for Seafair. It is, I think, back on TV this year.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait, it wasn't on TV last year?
Yeah, that was a really big story. You don't remember that?
I don't remember. I think I probably still streamed it, but it's back on network TV, back with Pat O'Day.
I don't know it's Pat O'Day, but Kong will be televising the racing on
there
Sunday.
There we go.
So if you are not planning to come out to Lake Washington, I will be there Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Oh, God.
Probably Thursday afternoon for the Blue Angels practice run. But if you're not going to do that, then check out Kong TV, which will be broadcasting at 3 to 6 p.m. on Sunday.
3 to 6 p.m.? That's kind of a weird time to be broadcasting it.
Well, it covers the final.
Are they going to broadcast the Blue Angels?
I don't think so, no, because wow. They would be earlier than that.
Where do you stand on the Blue Angels?
Overwhelmingly pro. Enjoying them with childlike glee and wonder.
It really is true. Overwhelmingly pro.
I had forgotten about their arrival on Monday. I happened to be outside as I was getting back from a run and saw them coming in at Boeing Field, which I can sort of see the approach from my house, and was disappointed that I hadn't caught the whole show.
Them flying in was a show?
Yeah, it's a bit of a show.
Oh, my God. Well, this is still – it's a landmark moment for Seattle in the summertime.
Look, it's the highlight of your summer, with all due respect to the block party.
This might be the highlight of your summer.
Oh, it certainly was a highlight of our summer as kids.
I've always enjoyed going to Water Follies more.
Well, yeah. Oh, I mean, as a fan experience, Water Follies is way better. Yeah.
But being there and watching those hydroplane races last week, and I was reminded how little I care. And just how boring the races are. I'm like, okay, so this is over. Like, I was walking back in from taking stuff to the car for the final, and I missed the first, like, half of a lap. And I was like, oh, it's over.
Yeah, it was.
It's just like, this is not an interesting sport. They need to figure out a way to make the sport more interesting. But I just don't think there are ways.
I don't think that's going to happen. Yeah.
They probably only have the chance now. Well. Yeah.
Well, on that note, if you've made it through all of this, I really appreciate you bearing with us in the tradition that is the Peltoncast Seafair Preview.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.